Jack Goldsmith was the Assistant Attorney General and head of the Office of Legal Counsel for about 9 months in 2003 and 2004 in the Bush administration. He has now put together a book about that experience and the conflicts that he found himself in the midst of in that position. The book is called The Terror Presidency. And Jack joins us live here this afternoon on KMOX. Hi, Jack. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
What was your job as Assistant AG and head of the Office of Legal Counsel? What's the job description there?
The job description is that it's an office of 22 lawyers, and as the head of the office, I was the person responsible for determining basically the legality of the president's counterterrorism actions. My legal decisions were binding on the executive branch, subject to review by the Attorney General and the President.
So were you one notch under John Ashcroft?
I was technically the number five person in the department, but yes, I reported to him, and he was the person who could overrule my decisions in the department.
And does that position, the Office of Legal Counsel, does that exist to tell the President what he can and can't do, or to figure out a way for the President to do whatever he wants?
It's certainly not the latter. I mean, I certainly tried very hard, and everyone in my job tried very hard to find a way for the president to do what he wanted to do lawfully. But it wasn't just a job to let the president do whatever he wanted to do and come up with an excuse for it.
Now, in the book, you write about a lot of the troublesome parts of your job, including brushes you had with some of your colleagues over things like how we fight terrorists and how we interrogate insurgents and people who are suspected enemy combatants and that sort of thing. Tell me a little bit about where the problems began. Was it right at the beginning when you had to give them an answer about the Geneva Convention and its application to terrorists and insurgents?
Yes. The first week I was on the job, I was asked by the White House to determine whether the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is different from the Prisoner of War Convention, it's a different treaty, whether it gave protections to terrorists in Iraq. And legal protections. And after a week of consulting with lawyers around the government, there was a consensus that the convention did provide these legal protections. And I did my own analysis and concluded that that was correct. And went over and told the White House, and they abided by the decision, but they weren't at all happy about it.
No, not that's to put it mildly. And there was a lot of debate about that in the first couple of years of the war, not only in your office and inside the White House, but all across the country. Can you explain to us why the Geneva Conventions would apply there, considering we're not technically at war with another nation at that point?
Well, we were at war. This was about, the question was whether the Geneva Convention applied in Iraq, and it was a traditional war between states, between nations, unlike the war against Al-Qaeda and perhaps some of the Taliban. This was a traditional interstate war. Both parties had ratified the convention. The government had acknowledged that the convention applied in full. The question was interpreting the convention, whether the convention that admittedly applied gave protections to terrorists, and it pretty clearly does.
When you were getting into discussions about this, not only with your legal colleagues inside the White House, but also with members of the administration, what was the role of Vice President Dick Cheney and his office in getting to the heart of what was going to be done?
Well, I didn't have any direct relationships with the Vice President, but his counsel, David Addington, who is now his chief of staff, replacing Scooter Libby, he was always in the room when the lawyers met to discuss these issues, and he was the loudest and strongest voice in the room for maintaining the president's prerogatives. So that's how I encountered the vice president's office.
You actually had quite a few sparring sessions, verbal sparring sessions, I guess we could call them, with David Addington, particularly over FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, right?
Yeah, we had some fights about that, some disagreements about some of the analysis and the interrogation opinions. Those two main areas.
Was FISA viewed by Addington and other people inside the White House as an obstacle in fighting terrorists?
Yes, it was. David said to me once that, in considering FISA, he said we're one bomb away from blowing up that obnoxious FISA court forever, by which he meant that he thought, I think this is what he meant, he thought that the 1978 FISA law was restricting the president's discretion to find and thwart the enemy, and that those restrictions would lead to another attack, and then that next attack would lead to the elimination of the law.
What did you think of that?
I worried about it a lot. I certainly worried that about tying the president's under the hands under the 1978 law. And I think the reforms from a few months ago are helpful. I guess I thought that we should work a little bit more with Congress or the FISA court than he did.
That right there seems to be the underlying theme of your book, that the Bush administration has tried to go all of this alone and didn't want to play nice with the judicial and congressional sides, the other two-thirds of the branches of government.
That is the main criticism of my book. I mean, a big theme in the book is that President Bush faces this administration and future presidencies face legal restrictions on their presidential powers, including criminal legal restrictions that put a huge chilling effect on the government in fighting the terrorists that are unprecedented, that no president has ever faced. And I think these are the restrictions and the problems that arise from the restrictions and the over-lawyerization of the war are serious problems, but I think that they would have gone about addressing these problems better if they had worked with Congress and the courts more openly and done it less on their own authority unilaterally.
Did they see Congress and the courts as almost an enemy?
No, I wouldn't say they were an enemy. I mean, but certainly with regard to Congress, the view in the White House was that, you know, if we go to Congress and seek Congress's support and we don't get all the support we ask for, we may end up in a weaker position. That may tie our hands. It may limit our powers and tie our hands and keep us from stopping the terrorists, and therefore we shouldn't take that risk.
But when
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but when it came to the FISA court, you know, they seemed to be trying to do these end runs around it, and Addington wanted to have nothing to do with it. Isn't it true that the FISA court pretty much was going along with all the requests that were sent its way?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. The FISA court traditionally grants most of the government's requests for warrants.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I think that the objection the administration made to it was that after 9/11, there were so many requests and it was so burdensome and time-consuming that it was impossible to comply with the procedures in a way that allowed us to move to meet the terrorists.
But you insisted still that they go that route.
Well, I can't get into this too much because it's classified, but I do say in the book that I had big clashes over their unilateral approach to these issues, yes. And in general, the attitude of the administration was we need to do this on our own to protect our power and to make sure our hands aren't tied. And to be fair, the White House worried quite genuinely about not being able to do what it takes to protect Americans because they worried that the law would be too restrictive. And I actually share their concerns. I just had some disagreements about the means and about some of the legal analysis.
Jack Goldsmith's book is called The Terror Presidency, The Terror Presidency, Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. We have a link to it now on KMOX.com in our KMOX Children's Hospital bookstore. As you know, when you buy the book through that link, we send a little bit of a commission right to the folks at Children's Hospital here in St. Louis. So that's the way you can get the book and help out here as well. Jack, when you left in 2004 and people asked you why you were leaving after less than a year, what did you tell them?
The main thing I told them, because I couldn't tell them everything, was, and it was true, but it wasn't the full explanation, was that I was exhausted and wanted to spend more time with my family.
That's always the excuse we hear.
It is always the excuse you hear. It was true in my case, but it wasn't the complete answer. I wasn't sure about what I could talk about with regard to the complete answer at the time.
Why can you be more complete with your answer now, 3 years later?
Because a lot of the events that I was involved in have become a matter of public record, talked about in the Congress and in official documents and the like. So I feel at liberty to talk about them now.
In our last segment, you mentioned the over-lawyerization of the war. What does that mean?
What it means is two things. One, there is most people don't understand the extent to which legal restrictions govern everything that the president does in war. And when there are legal restrictions, especially when they're vague and especially when they concern criminal law, that means that lawyers have a very important role in defining those limits. And by over-lawyerization, I meant that there's a lot of law and, you know, tens of thousands of lawyers. Not in the war, but the CIA has over 100 lawyers. The Department of Defense has over 10,000 lawyers. We don't drop a bomb in this country without having the target vetted by one or two lawyers. There are many good aspects about law and lawyers regulating wartime, but there are some pathologies as well.
What's good about it?
What's good about it is that we comply with the rule of law even during wartime. What's good about it is that law can, the legal restrictions that surround the president have been responses to abuses and problems in the past, especially in the Watergate era. The problem is that these laws grew up in an era before 9/11, before the challenges of 9/11, and a whole set of enforcement mechanisms grew up before 9/11. And it's not clear that the kind of regime we have for controlling the president in the pre-9/11 world is the right one for the post-9/11 world.
Okay. What's bad about it?
What's bad about it is that, several things. First of all, when you have all this law and lawyers drawing the limits, it shifts accountability for the terrorism decisions that keep us safe or not to lawyers who aren't accountable and who aren't elected for the most part. And those lawyers can give good or bad answers. They can sometimes say, yes, you can do that, Mr. President. The answer should be no. Or they can sometimes say, well, I'm not so sure. You better go slow. Or I don't think you can do that, when the answer should be yes. And so those in a nutshell are the problems.
When you would have these disagreements with David Addington and Alberto Gonzalez and others inside the Attorney General's office and the Office of Legal Counsel, were they genuine disagreements about the law, or was it about presidential power and pushing policy forward?
No, I think ultimately they were genuine disagreements about the law, but they were, you know, the scope of executive power, of course, is a legal issue. And a lot of the debates were premised on different understandings of executive power. But the people I disagreed with were that they were certainly making good faith efforts to keep the country safe, and in my opinion, they were making good faith interpretations of the law. They just had we had sharp disagreements about what the proper principles were.
I mentioned Alberto Gonzalez, who was involved in that famous scene on March 10th, 2004, in then-Attorney General John Ashcroft's hospital bed, when Gonzalez and Andrew Card, who was then the White House chief of staff, went to the hospital to demand that John Ashcroft approve a secret program that was about to expire. You objected to that, and you were in that room that day, weren't you?
I was in the room. I was there with Deputy Attorney General and Acting Attorney General Jim Comey, who was basically acting on legal advice that I gave him and that he agreed with.
What was the Attorney General John Ashcroft's reaction to people coming in? And here he was, you know, it was not a good day for him.
It was a terrible day for him. He had had a very serious operation on his pancreas the day before. When I saw him, when I walked in the room, I was stunned at how weak he looked. He had lost a lot of weight since I'd seen him last, and he did not look well. And I wasn't sure how he was going to handle the confrontation with the White House, with Judge Gonzalez and Andrew Card. But when they made their request, he kind of pulled himself together and gave a very articulate and really inspiring refutation of their request, and said he didn't appreciate them coming here under those circumstances, and he said that that Jim Comey was the acting attorney general in any event. So he really gave an amazing performance on what I thought might have been his deathbed.
And the White House wanted to go past his objections and yours and others and still implement that program, right?
There were some, unfortunately, I'm sorry, I can't talk about it too much, but that's basically what Jim Comey testified to, yes. And just let me say that, you know, the reason they were in the hospital room, they weren't there, I don't think, because they wanted to flout the law. They were there because they were suffering or feeling these twin pressures that I talk about in the book and that are at the center of all these debates. On the one hand, they were really fearful that pulling back the president's authorities or limiting the president's discretion might lead us to fail to stop another attack, and they were also really fearful of violating the law. If you think about it for a second, it's pretty amazing that the White House was coming to the Attorney General's hospital bed to seek permission to do something that they wanted to do, because the president is technically the chief legal advisor of the government. So I really think the hospital scene embodied these conflicting pressures that the White House and really all counterterrorism officials felt.
You know, one of the things that critics of this administration have said repeatedly is that it has used fear, particularly in this post-9/11 world, it has used fear, and particularly fear of terrorist attack, as a way to scare people into either agreeing or acquiescing, if you will, with whatever it wanted to do. And there's a quote in your book from David Addington, who was then legal advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, who said to you at one point about another presidential decision, quote, if you rule that way, the blood of the 100,000 people who die in the next attack will be on your hands, which seems to indicate that they were even using fear with their own people.
Well, yes and no. I mean, David was genuinely fearful of that attack, I think, and frankly, so was I. And I don't think, you know, he might or might not have been trying to intimidate me to make a different decision, but I will say that even if he hadn't said that to me, I would have felt that pressure because that was what the stakes seemed to be inside the government. It seemed to be that, you know, there were these really horrifying threat reports that came through every morning that were really frightening to look at, frankly, and especially frightening because one got the sense that there was this terrible attack that may be out there, but also had a sense that we lacked the tools or resources to fully prevent it. So I do think that they were fearful, and I do think that fear sort of affected our judgments, but I don't think they were lying about the fear in order to expand their power. I don't think that's quite an accurate account.
The book is called The Terror Presidency, Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. He held that office for 9 months in 2003 and 2004, which means he was there pretty much through the first year of our war in Iraq. And ever since 9/11, of course, the war against terrorists and the attempt to stop them and bring them, I was going to say to justice has been a big part of this, but the question about how to bring suspected terrorists or enemy combatants to justice was part of what you were arguing about a lot inside the White House, wasn't it?
It was. I worked on this question when I was in the Defense Department for a year before I came to the Justice Department, and I worked a lot on detention and military commission issues. And I basically agreed with the administration's goals in establishing military detention and military commission institutions to try and detain terrorists. And I thought they had good legal arguments as well, but I, and much more vigorously than I did others, argued after a while that we'd be on a lot better basis if we went to Congress and got their express approval for these policies. I thought that the approval was implicit in the original authorization for the war, but for a lot of prudential reasons, it seemed like a good idea to go to Congress, especially since courts were becoming anxious about these policies. And that view did not prevail until long after I left the government, after the government had lost a lot of cases in the Supreme Court that probably could have been avoided.
Do you think that if Congress had been brought in earlier, that the Supreme Court might have looked at it and said, well, you got the White House and Congress that are both in favor of this, so as a third branch of government, we're going to go along now?
There's no doubt that that's true. That's exactly what the court held in 2006 when it struck down the military commissions. It basically said, the president can't do this on his own. He needs to get Congress on board. And the president went to Congress a few months later, and Congress gave him everything he asked for and more. And if he had done that 3 or 4 years earlier, he would have avoided a lot of defeats in courts, and I think would have been in a much better position about all this stuff.
Yeah. Is the same true about torture and surveillance and all of those things?
Well, those are all harder to discuss publicly, and interrogation is hard to discuss publicly because you don't want to tip off the enemy about your interrogation policies. But we've had debates about that, and Congress has twice legislated on that issue since 2005. Surveillance, again, is hard because you don't want to reveal your techniques to the enemy. But again, when the president did go to the Congress for surveillance just a few months ago, from a Democratic Congress, he received extraordinary and unprecedented authorizations. And one of the things I talk about in the book is the importance, all the values that are served by doing this. It educates the public. It forces Congress to be accountable. They can't just sit on the sidelines and complain, and they have to actually stand up and be counted. It puts all the decisions on a more legitimate basis. So I think the administration would have been better served by doing this a lot earlier.
Jack, in reading the book, it seems that one of the underlying themes of the book, and maybe it's the underlying theme, is your concern about the expansion of presidential powers. It seems to me like you're a constitutional scholar, and as a civil libertarian myself, this is one of the things that always concerns me when people in power want to grab even more power. But it seems that your concern about it was not necessarily just about this administration, but about what it was going to set as a precedent for future administrations. Am I reading it right?
That's basically right. I mean, it wasn't just that I was certainly concerned about the expansion of executive power, but at the same time, being inside the executive branch and looking at the threat reports, I also had an enhanced appreciation of why we need a strong presidency. And the trick in wartime and crisis, and I do think we face a long emergency in this fight against terrorists, the trick is to enhance presidential power enough to enable the president to keep us safe, but to ensure that he's subject to the sort of control mechanisms of democratic accountability. And I think those things have to go hand in hand if we're going to defeat the terrorists and maintain our constitutional values.
I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you one last question before you go, and that is your thoughts on President Bush today nominating former federal judge Michael Mukasey as his nominee for the post of Attorney General.
I do not know Judge Mukasey personally. I know his decisions. I think it's an outstanding choice. He's someone who knows and understands the terrorist problem really firsthand. He presided over some of the most important terrorism trials in the 1990s and early 2000s. And he's also someone with an outstanding reputation for rule of law commitments and for independence and integrity. So I think the president made a great choice today.
If they had called you, would you have wanted to be considered for that job?
No, they would never have called me, and I would not have wanted to be considered for it.
Jack Goldsmith is now a professor of law at Harvard University. His book is called The Terror Presidency, Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Jack Goldsmith, former Assistant Attorney General and head of the Office of Legal Counsel here on The Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.